Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 70, section 8, which is old single column, page 792. Okay, I think the only intro we need is just recall that in the preceding section, they were talking about primitive clubs and secret societies, and remember the kind of the underlying fact there, regardless of the details, is that there are influences that come in play very early on that establish subgroups within the overall group that you have. Once you get past that initial, very primitive state of the horde, it begins to move into a state where you have some degree of subgroups, of subsetting of the tribe. For instance, remember we pointed out that initially you literally still have the clans within the tribe, but slowly definitive clans basically melt away, but you have these subgroups that continue on as effectively clan-like in various ways. So, it's inescapable that you don't have a monolithic fact once you leave that very beginning state behind. And as soon as there's any sort of separation, there's going, that allows a differential of elevation to occur. Those that really don't have any ability to move vertically will hold the whole group down if the group is sort of locked together. But once you break it into subgroups, you naturally begin to build a social hierarchy. And so that's the main point of this section, is to deal with the basic aspects of that social complexifying, if you will, that naturally occurs. Okay, so let's get into it here.
Section 8, social classes. The mental and physical inequality of human beings ensures that social classes will appear. The only worlds without social strata are the most primitive and the most advanced. A dawning civilization has not yet begun the differentiation of social levels, while a world settled in light and life has largely effaced these divisions of mankind, which are so characteristic of all intermediate evolutionary stages.
So all intermediate evolutionary stages. Now, so you can see them pointing out, as I was there, that the dawning civilization has not yet begun the differentiation of social levels, because you're in that locked, tight together horde state. As we've talked about in the past, when we've gone through talking about light and life, obviously eventually you've elevated all of the genetics. You've lost that that spectrum, that bell curve of genetic nature that they're talking about, physical inequality. Things have been brought into a very tight and elevated biologic state. And you have a very effective educational system to take all of the potential, mind potential, or mental, intellectual potential seated upon that sound biologic foundation, and to bring it up, ever more so as kindred minds. You have the two ends. You might even, suspect that in some there may be a superconscious recognition of that future state, they go searching for that, but in a non-discriminating fashion, equate the horde state with the light and life state. We've seen that. They think they're going towards light and life, but actually they're going directly 180 degrees opposite, trying to drive things back to the horde in order to achieve the realization of what they desire, to close their eyes to the statement at the beginning there that the mental and physical inequality of human beings ensures, etc. Yes, we all know there are abuses associated with social classes. So when they say that ensures that social classes will appear, that's another mode that someone could be in. It's like, I judge the value of social classes by the worst examples that I can think of abuses of social classes, like caste. Therefore, I throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like they're saying there, it goes hand in hand because the inequality and those social classes are coupled, that you are going to just declare that all men are born equal. For no other reason, so that this inescapable logic is not in play. If they're born equal, then you don't have, any natural insurance of social classes.
Problem solved.
Right. So in many different ways, you can reflect on the statements in that paragraph and think about how there's people with a little bit of spiritual consciousness that could find themselves lost in an ignorant space where they think they've found the fulfillment of their idealistic recognition, but they've gone way off into a lost domain relative to wisdom. We're building up in this section to one of our indispensables here. We'll see that as we kind of get through this big list that's coming up here. Before we get there, they give it this all of this detail, these 10 bullet points. So let's read their little preface there and see what the point of this big list is here.
As society emerged from savagery to barbarism, its human components tended to become grouped in classes for the following general reasons.
Okay, now it sounds like it's a pretty boilerplate sort of intro, but notice the little things. It's human components. So they're reminding you that bringing in a little bit more reflective thinking, even if it's rudimentary, augments this sorting phenomenon, breaking up into classes. If you're just going around as a sort of a clueless, fancy animal, right, there's no discrimination. There's again one of those elements where we've, again, in the mode I was talking about, how we get wrapped around the axle with the things in that first paragraph. And because of that, the word discrimination has become a negative word instead of one of the most sublime of human words. That's what distinguishes the human from the animal is the ability to discriminate. But, you know, if you try to just lower us all down to a least common denominator of animal nature, you know, if you continue to use the word discrimination, it's going to be a negative word. If for no other reason, it's like, well, wait a minute, if I discriminate, I'm going to break things into social classes, and that's innately evil, and you know, just there's so much confusion surrounding this. And then even the, you know, what's becoming all the more politically correct with each passing year, you know, especially relative to the beginning of the 20th century, you know, to use words like savagery and barbarism. You know, how dare you, you know, label people as savaged, barbarian, civilized. But, you know, use those labels the revelators do. And it's I don't think we've actually paused and reflected on that a little bit. What's the gist of that differentiation? You know, to invoke the word savage is to say that that the human is functioning, you know, basically almost totally as nothing but an animal. You know, in terms of the way they behave, what they manifest. You're not seeing human quality of expression. You know, so savage is very much animalistic. Okay, and then the barbarian, I mean, literally in the coining of the word, it's the thought that when people with Andite blood experienced more Sangic peoples, their language sounds unsophisticated, and it's just bar, 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 bar. See, so in technically what's going on there is, okay, you're above savage as a barbarian, but you aren't manifesting that higher consciousness that the Adamic uplift brings into play. You know, it's a fundamentally limited civilizable state because of genetics and the lack of biologic uplift. See, so that's the distinction you're making as you go from savage to barbarian to, you know, at least semi-civilized. You're indicating, you know, a movement from animal to more definitive human, that the biologic uplift allows, you know, for the expression of. Okay.
Is there any relation to like the levels of meaning or the adjutants? Or...
Well, there's always going to be, you know, a rough parallel. I mean, not a precise parallel, but a rough parallel. As you, you know, go from savage to civilized, you're obviously moving up to higher levels of meaning. Right? I mean, just by definition, there is higher meaning in play as you become more and more civilized. But not necessarily, you know, where savage is this level of meaning, barbarian is this level. I mean, don't think about it quite like that. Yeah, but just there's a rough parallel. Yeah.
One way I've thought of it is that a savage does not recognize any rulership. Barbarian doesn't recognize law, but he recognizes the right to rule.
Uh-huh.
And the civilized man recognizes the law.
And yeah, I mean that's yeah, like I said, you mean there's a number of ways that you could put things in a rough parallel and further understand that spectrum from savage to barbarian to civilized. But it, you know, I mean, definitely, like you were saying, you know, if they're saying sort of full on savage, you probably have something that's very much in the horde like state, you know, where there just really isn't any differentiation. There's no chief or, you know, it's all just this sort of mindless collective phenomenon. Yeah, that would definitely be the case. I think they even bring that up at some point in here. All right, so anyway, but the thing that really you want to carry forward is that its human components tended to become grouped. So the more animalistic, see, has less of a tendency, see, you know, it's, you notice how that, just that fact is a bit politically incorrect, right? Like I said, this bias, you know, in the sense that social classes are innately bad, and you're going away from human nature if you're going towards social classes. See, the revelators are saying, no, it's the opposite. You're thinking 180 degrees turned around. I mean, yes, you don't have, they aren't expressions of eternity, right? You don't find social classes in eternity, per se, any more than you find them in a world deeply settled in light and life. But nonetheless, you know, thinking that you are, you're on the advancing half of the whole progress of civilization spectrum, rather than on the early half, so that when you look towards that high level of relationship to unity, you're looking forward in time instead of backward in time. See, you know, that's the mistake that's being made, and I think mistake is probably, you know, the proper word. You know, you're going to definitely end up bringing in, structures in your society that disrupt relationship to unity rather than foster it. And by doing that, change without growth is potential evil, those sorts of statements that the revelators give you. Okay, so anyway, let's look at these one at a time here. What are these 10 different modes here?
One, natural. Contact, kinship, and marriage. The first social distinctions were based on sex, age, and blood. Kinship to the chief.
Okay, so now that all sounds straightforward, but just pause and reflect a little bit. It's like, okay, is there elements of that that I see in play very definitively today? I mean, do we not, you know, are we not struggling with, you know, things we call like ageism today, right? You know, differentiating by age. See, it all depends on how aggressively you're trying to believe in all men are born equal. I mean, you know, maybe it's not just born equal, but they should or they do remain equal as they're born. And so any recognition of the fact that we change as we age is ageist, right? Is wrong. All right, so, but beginning humans that aren't filled with all sorts of foolish notions recognize the obvious. No, you have to take into account age. You can't treat a three-year-old the same as a 70-year-old, the same as a 40-year-old. You know, they aren't interchangeable by age, let alone interchangeable by sex. Oh, my goodness. I can't think that. And of course, you know, you can see there one of the things that you're struggling with in finally melting away the definitive clan concept is this distinction by blood, you know, by kinship to the chief, you know, and that the fact that I'm of that kin makes me better than being of that kin, that other kin, those sorts of things. So yeah, there are some negative elements that need to be left behind, but anyway, just the fact that this is naturally going to be in place, and then we start to try to do things unnatural, bring in some artificial, but we do it without any wisdom, and we actually end up with a worse situation. I mean, there's none so blind as those who will not see the difference due to age. or due to gender. Okay, so that's the kind of things. You know, what's the truth that's flowing through that simple fact that you see is still a very difficult thing we're struggling with today? All right.
Two, personal. The recognition of ability, endurance, skill, and fortitude, soon followed by the recognition of language mastery, knowledge, and general intelligence.
Well, the thing that should strike you is the bullet title.
Yeah.
Personal.
Yeah, wow.
Right? Human components. It's like, well, I mean, do they really mean personal, or do they just mean, you know, individuality differential? No, notice the word that they repeat. The recognition of. The recognition of. Right? That discrimination, using your three cosmic intuitions, that'll give you objective recognition. You objectively recognize that this isn't just something arbitrary. This is an objective difference, you know, relative to fortitude, say. All right, so, I mean, see, again, like they said, its human components tended to become, because they can get above the material facts and recognize top down the differences. And it's like, well, we need to sort this, you know. And
so that comes second. Is this in order?
Yes and no. You can obviously see some, you know, some sense of order there. Even within that one, notice the first thing is ability, endurance, skill, fortitude. That has a lot to do with the first level of meaning.
I thought it sounded like playing football.
Well, first level of meaning, level of the flesh. Then when you get to language mastery, knowledge, general intelligence, so you're bringing in a little bit more of the second level of meaning. In other words, the first three adjutants in the first case, the next three adjutants in the second case. Right, so you're moving up, you know, getting a higher and higher vantage point for discriminating differences. So it is, you know, it's taking a degree of personal consciousness to do that. In contrast to the first one called natural, which is, you know, a lot more immediate, you know. It doesn't take a lot of reflection to figure out that, you know, who's related to whom, and, you know, and whether you're male or female. You know, usually you can just check behind the loincloth, you know, these sorts of things. It's fairly straightforward. You don't have to reflect very deeply. Okay? See, so like you're saying, you can see there, you know, there is some degree of progression to more complex things as you move through the list here. Yeah. All right, but you know, the thing that really, yeah, you know, the politically incorrect thing there is between the lines with the word recognition. The word recognition implies discrimination. The proper sense, you know, where the difference is too subtle for a fancy animal to notice. But a human can get up above and notice that subtle difference. That's what discrimination is about, as opposed to just, you know, to distinguish, you know, a difference, you know. But to discriminate, you know, is to pick up on a subtlety that only reflective thinking can see.
Three, chance. War and immigration resulted in the separating of human groups. Class evolution was powerfully influenced by conquest, the relation of the victor to the vanquished. While slavery brought about the first general division of society into free and bond.
Okay, so that one, they bring in those first two indispensables of slavery and war. And their role in getting to the third indispensable of social classes. Let's see. What do we have, Eric? I mean, that's pretty straightforward. I mean, maybe one little thing. It gets more and more difficult as we get, as we begin to have higher thoughts, to accept yourself as the vanquished rather than the victor. That's a little thing between the lines there. People were, they faced facts more easily in the past when you weren't so sophisticated, quote unquote, of thinking, I'm the vanquished or I'm the victor. Remember what they, how they ended the preceding section. These societies gave rise to the first political parties. The first party government was the strong versus the weak, right? And you labeled yourself as the weak. You weren't being labeled by others as a put down. It's like, okay, I'm obviously the weak. I lost the war. I accept that fact, and I will live with that fact. The strong should be ruling over me because they are obviously the strong. I'm the vanquished. Now I have no right to rule. I need to submit. It's a little bit of that sort of alpha dog, sort of a thing, right? Because again, it's you're just playing off of some of those initial animal sensibilities. Yeah.
Our modern reluctance to accept this is reflected in this recent recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
This is the fourth president who's promised to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel based on their...
Or you could say going all the way back to Truman, if you wanted to be more complete about it, not just the recent ones, right? But yes, I mean, you can see in a lot of ways when people are given, remember, this is part of the rebellion playing out. One of the reasons why it's become more difficult for humans to accept their lot, in basic physical struggle, is the preachings of Caligastia and crew 200,000 years ago. Saying that you have certain rights that, not in a primitive state. You can't have those quote-unquote rights. I have the right to always be the victor, or something like this. Obviously, if you believe you're innately divine, well, then isn't it obvious that I have the right to always be the victor? These sorts of things. It gets very confused. There's you totally short-circuit the evolutionary process. Yes, in primitive times, it's a crude process, but it is the process. It is God's way.
People also play the victim,
right? And then of course, then you can get clever, and it's like, ooh, I could play this. I could play the victim. Sure, you can see how it can be abused, and like I've mentioned at the beginning, that's always a problem. As soon as someone abuses something, we're often quick to judge it by the abuses, not treat it objectively. Like the silly assumption of the skeptics, falsehood exists, therefore truth doesn't exist. That may be a little bit of an overplay. or anything that's parallel to that. So anyway, you get the idea. There's subtle little things like that. If you pause and reflect, you'll see that a statement of basic fact that was easily accepted in the past is no longer easily accepted. This is the building emergency. One must face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. Right? There's no way we can get from the material comfort era to the quest for knowledge and wisdom if we can't face facts. If we're willfully closing our eyes to facts that we find inconvenient, like the difference between men and women, or the fact that you lost, or even that someone has to lose, right, in a sporting event. You know, everyone gets a trophy. You know, whatever it is. Yeah. Okay.
Four, economic. Rich and poor. Wealth and the possession of slaves was a genetic basis for one class of society.
Okay, that's pretty straightforward. Yeah, other than kind of parallel to what I was just saying, I mean, you know, accepting the fact of rich on the one hand and poor on the other hand. But notice the interesting use of words there. Because of, you know, we're post-discovery of DNA, when you hear that genetic basis for one class of a society, you can't help but hear genetic as in genetics. But, you know, if you reflect on it a little bit, you know, see, more immediately, it's genetic in the sense of genesis, origin, right? Right, it's, you know, it was the basis for the, you know, the origin of one class of society. I mean, that's what it's most immediately saying. However, see, delightfully, right, underneath that is genetics, right? You know, and recognizing there is a definite genetics element to rich and poor. Right? It's not, as some people love to say, you know, because all men are born equal, so there is no genetic differences. You know, if you're rich instead of poor, well, you won life's lottery. No, maybe you just have better genetics and you can think better. And you can figure out how to acquire capital and maintain it. Right. So it's a very interesting, you know, selection of words there.
Then you have a hard time getting through the eye of the needle.
Yeah, right. And then you come up against all of the historical, right, demonization of the rich, right. So, like I said, that's the politically incorrect thing that's, you know, kind of between the lines there, too. But anyway, it's always delightful to just notice how, with a few words, they can get you thinking into a whole space where we could spend the rest of the time tonight just talking about all of the social issues and tensions, you know, swirling about bullet point number four, and how much we get wrapped around the axle, and how much it's been turned into theology, and, you know, and thought of as an existential difference, and a blockage to even get to heaven. You know, there's no way you can get to heaven if you're rich, and, you know, I mean, it's gone off in all sorts of unfortunate tangents. Every one of these things is like that. Because social classes are controversial. There's always every human has that animal origin nature that's incessantly clamoring for recognition and honor, and has a difficult time when your value is, or your apparent value, I should say, is not as easily observable. As with some, it's like, well, he's rich. I mean, his value is apparent, you know, or whatever. He's obviously a great man. Look at how many slaves he owns. I mean, that was a way it was often, you know, a person was graded in the past. Yeah, you know, there's always that tension. Now, what about me? You know, me too. That incessant clamoring, not wanting to find itself down a notch in some social hierarchy.
Except that you remember about, you know, if you can live life, like being happy to be a tadpole.
Yeah.
Really happy.
Yeah. Right, happy to.
What we're given.
Yeah, happy to be a tadpole and the mental and physical inequality. Only, but the spiritual equality, right? Mental and physical inequality, but spiritual equality. You know, but the fact that we haven't been able to get to spirit. See, we haven't been able to get to the actual domain where the word equal is meant to be used. Right? And so we're constantly trying to make mind or matter a substitute for spirit. Because it's sad to record that our spiritual equality is not self-evident to anyone, basically. Right? And so they're constantly looking for mental uniformity or physical uniformity as the poor man's unity to put this equality label on. Right? That's the challenge, to do what hasn't been done yet. Actually separate abstract spirit from mind. And you may have to back up a notch and actually separate mind from matter first, because you've been trained to forget about that distinction. But you know, reestablish that. That was there 150 years ago. And rediscover that, that fact. And then see if you can work on that next step, separating spirit from your feelings. Right? Find something within you that has nothing to do with feelings, that's transcendent of feelings, and you'll finally have found spirit.
Even Lucifer, though, it wasn't as above, so below. It's my right to be above while I'm below.
Right. Yeah, it's my right to reject the hierarchy because I know it's an arbitrary imposition by foreign potentates or whatever. Yeah. Anyway. So. Okay. Keep going here.
5, geographic classes arose consequent upon urban or rural settlement. City and country have respectively contributed to the differentiation of the herder-agriculturist and the trader-industrialist with their divergent viewpoints and reactions.
Okay, now that one, that one's relatively straightforward, but we all know there's been and continues to be lots of tension. Just think about how that natural social classing could even eventually get codified as political parties. I shouldn't have to explain how it's pretty obvious that we have tendencies in that way to end up with as we tend to say, politicizing in our sort of unfortunate use of the word political as kind of a negative word, but politicizing of that, which further, when you do that, you recognize that adds even a greater tendency to existentialize class differences, to think of them as not facts of time, but facts of eternity. Inescapable facts of eternity. This is just you're born eternally into this estate. Because we certainly love to set up dichotomies politically, and that turns into a false good on one side of the line, bad on the other side of the line, and we existentialize it like that. All right.
6, social. Classes have gradually formed according to popular estimate of the social worth of different groups. Among the earliest divisions of this sort were the demarcations between priest-teachers, ruler-warriors, capitalist-traders, common laborers, and slaves. The slave could never become a capitalist, though sometimes the wage earner could elect to join the capitalistic ranks.
Okay. You'll see they're hinting at flexibility there that they'll get to when we're done with the list here, speaking to that directly. having these classes not be solidified into caste, so that there's, at least in some instances, the potential to move from one class to another. Now, this one, you're going, okay, so one of the general reasons for social classes is social? Yeah, that seems fairly obvious. notice in the context of everything else, I mean, there's reasons that are sort of just immediately quote-unquote social, and then ones that are, off to the side of that, but then have a social consequence. But there is obviously going to be just merely social reasons, and notice the way they word that. According to popular estimate of the social worth of different groups, reminding you of how much the more system varies with time, what you mean by a proper estimate. In other words, what's the popular estimate? What conforms to the mores system of the time? What's politically correct for that time? That's the popular estimate.
I don't really understand why, but I recognize the difference. They're talking about capitalist traders and capitalist, but in that last phrase, the wage earner could elect to join the capitalistic ranks, not the capitalist ranks, but the capitalistic ranks.
Well, just, using that adjective to get you to, to think not so much in terms of, individuals who are capitalists, but the process of acquiring and maintaining capital, right? In general, the wage earner is living paycheck to paycheck, right, and cannot accumulate capital. Right, but to get to the point where there's enough profiting from your labors that you actually have something left over at the end of the week that can carry forward to the next week. Okay, so that's the capitalistic ranks. Those who have found a mode to function in that isn't so hand to mouth. That they're struggling a bit with the language. We've talked about this before. When we brought up capital, yes, capitalism. Okay, that's an issue. And yet, there isn't another word. So at times they have to kind of use, words that are, capitalist, is tied to capitalism, the ist of the ism. But, trying to get you to abstract the truth, from it. And remember how many times they know that by using the word capitalism, you're immediately thinking of the abuses, and so they actually, in print, remind you. We're fully aware of the abuses of capital. Nonetheless, there's a truth flowing through it. Saying it like that, capitalistic, adding that additional suffix, tempers it a little bit. Not joining the ranks of the cold, heartless capitalists, right? that's just one little play on the language there. All right. Let's see. Anything else we need to bring out there? Just to remind you before we go on, that important element that I was stressing, that um, We're going to get into that in the next section very definitively. We have to try to maintain an objectivity about the sense of the times that you live in, and to not think of it, not to existentialize it. You know, you're at a particular stage in a long evolutionary process. You're a long ways from the end. Yes, you may be a long ways from the beginning too, but you're a long ways from the end. And you know, and don't think about how, don't think that you're, we've got it. We can carve this in stone. This is the proper estimate. You know, it's not just the popular estimate at the time of what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. You know, and again, I'm purposely throwing in those words because we bring in those words that are way, an overplay of what's really going on. It doesn't have anything to do with good and bad, right and wrong. You know, it's not a moral issue, a spiritual issue. I mean, it's just a simple factual issue, or it's totally relative to the point in the evolutionary process that you are. You shouldn't existentialize it like that. You know, or even think of it as somehow attuning to supremacy. Right, it's just a fact of time. Yeah. Okay.
7, vocational. As vocations multiplied, they tended to establish castes and guilds. Workers divided into 3 groups: the professional classes, including the medicine men, then the skilled workers, followed by the unskilled laborers.
Okay, now notice they threw in castes there. Think about that, how, especially if you get into highly skilled laborers, it takes so much to get to that state that it's going to tend to set up, a very definitive caste of those kinds of workers, and you're born into that. And in order to get that skill, you have to immediately, like the little boy has to immediately, be watching his father, day in and day out. And and when his father is finally too old, his son takes over. So it ends up, becoming very difficult for anyone to get out of that. The little child has a natural tendency to identify with the parent, mother or father, and they're not thinking you're not the boss of me. You know, that's not the first thought out of a little child's head. So, see, they're pointing out that you start to go from class to caste.
Before modern education methods, this was kind of standard.
Yeah,
how people raise their kids. At a certain age, a child was apprenticed.
Yep.
The parents would decide what they thought they would most fit into, and they would probably pay someone to take their poor child.
Yep. Yep.
And teach them.
Yep. Right.
A trade.
Yeah, for those in the webinar, he's bringing up, historically, the concept of apprenticeships and how it was not only traditional, like I was just trying to point out, in a number of ways, it's the only practical solution to getting educated. In some way that you can support yourself. And of course, we're starting to discover we need to get back into the truth of that some. We've gotten way off in airy-fairy theoretical land, thinking we should, educate every child to be some sort of flighty theorist in some field of human thought, and they can't support themselves. You can't get a job, except for the handful of people who live in the ivory towers, with that sort of training of your mind. And so you end up being a barista, right, with your PhD. you know, in some completely impractical field.
Jessica was going to undergraduate architecture school on the second year. There were 180 students, and they always cut them to 30.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a big cut. A lot of them were weeded out, quit by then.
Well, in an educational institution that, especially in a discipline in that educational institution that has a definitive connection to the industry tied to that discipline, right? There's some sense of, well, we don't need 100,000 of these of these individuals. But we all know, you know, more and more we've just been completely unwise about this. It's like, no, everyone should go to college, you know, and get a degree in something. So, obviously vocational, there's lots of need for wisdom there, but just also appreciating that, you know, getting back to the point, we don't want to lose sight that we're talking about social classes here, that, you know, it's inescapable. You can't escape the naturalness of what vocation does relative to social classes. You know, it leads to social classes, if not castes. Vocation does. And so it's a very strong driver to create subgroups. And so, you know, it can be seen as an affront to unity by, you know, the simple-minded, spiritually conscious person. And it's like, well, you know, we should just eliminate all vocations. You know, we should all just, you know, just hang out together. And those sorts of impractical thoughts. Okay.
8. Religious. The early cult clubs produced their own classes within the clans and tribes, and the piety and mysticism of the priests have long perpetuated them as a separate social group.
Okay, so there's the preceding section. You know, they're bringing that in. Like I said, that was obviously, they were hinting at this setting up. Subsetting of the collective, and there, so, you know, so there is that directly, these cult clubs, and just bringing in that additional element, you know, the piety and mysticism of the priests, the fact that, like I was saying a little bit ago, that so-called religionists have never genuinely got to spirit. You know, to an inner life domain called religion, but instead have carved out eccentric outer life domains that are called religious, you know, with these very odd and precise ritual elements, you know, the piety that they're talking about there. I mean, they have to form a subgroup because, I mean, they don't fit in with anyone else. You know, 50 times a day they've got to do such and so. It's like, well, you know, you can't get along with anyone else if you're going to have to do that 50 times a day. You're going to have to just kind of go in your own little group in order to maintain that piety.
Wash your hands.
Whatever it is, right? We can all think about. And of course, we struggle with that. You know, we want this freedom of religious expression. It's like, yes, but if you are just totally OCD, about material issues in your so-called religion, it becomes completely impossible for you to be assimilated into the rest of society. You know, and if they're very fundamentalist, their response is, well, no, we're not the problem. You are. Everyone should become pious and separated like us, and then we'll all be together in this, you know, divorced from reality domain that we've constructed out of our imagination. Anyway, so that's the that's the obvious tensions there. But like I said, see, it's there shouldn't be tension like that if you had genuine religion. Genuine religion doesn't produce any of those tensions because it's not an outer life phenomenon. It's an inner life phenomenon. Yeah. Okay. Next one here.
9. Racial. The presence of two or more races within a given nation or territorial unit usually produces color castes. The original caste system of India was based on color, as was that of early Egypt.
Yeah, so not only do you have Sangic, you know, differences leading to color castes, but you're obviously going to have a tendency, if you have any Andite injection into that, you know, that territorial unit, you know, they're talking about there, that's going to differentiate them. You know, obviously, you know that happened in India when, you know, the tail of the Andite phenomenon penetrated into northern India as the Aryans, you know, and producing definite caste phenomena. And that reminds you of when you've got that, you're innately going to have those who see themselves as civilized in one caste, and they look upon the individuals of the other castes as barbarians. So to bring in that civilized barbarian contrast,
untouchables.
Yeah, if not even worse than barbarian, you know, but all the way to untouchable or something. Yes. Let's see. Anything else there? I mean, I think everyone understands what they're referring to with. I mean, everyone understands India, but with Egypt, you know, you obviously. As you head down to Nubia, right, from, you know, because there you had those Andites coming into northern, you know, Egypt there and immediately setting up this tension, you know, with the more southern African secondary Sangic stocks, you know.
These classes have come up very recently because in England, back when Churchill was a young man, part of the proper accoutrement or dress of a gentleman was a cane.
A cane, uh-huh.
And the use of that cane was to, it was socially permissible to cane a lower class individual. There was no, they had to maintain their status.
Yeah.
And there was nothing bad would happen to you.
Right. It was part of the mores system. That you could literally use this required cane, to keep the separation amongst the classes, lest they kind of ooze too close to you. Just swat them away with your cane. Yeah. I mean, that's the sort of thing, you know, they occasionally throw in little tidbits like that. And did you ever wonder where the whole thing of, you know, the upper class carrying a cane came from? They often do that, you know. Yeah, so that's a good kind of revelatory spirit point to bring up about how we have these, and then, you know, time goes by and no one has any clue about, I just carry this cane because I'm supposed to do it, but I don't think it has any functional purpose. You know, it's just an accessory that, you know, indicates my status or something. It's like, no, it had a literal physical use, practical, quote unquote, use.
Yeah. Who knew? They had blood all over the body.
Yeah, right. Yeah, hopefully there wasn't a retractable spike that could come out of the bottom of your cane. Yes. Yeah. All right. One more here.
10. Age, youth, and maturity. Among the tribes, the boy remained under the watch care of his father as long as the father lived, while the girl was left in the care of her mother until married.
Okay, now that one you might not initially think of in terms of social classes. But remember, one of the key things about differences between the classes is there's a difference of mores system. Right? You start out with a very uniform mores system, but as you begin to form these social classes, you not only have a hierarchy in society, but you develop a hierarchy, you know, levels of the mores system. You know, and for this group, they're allowed to do certain things that other group is not allowed to do, and vice versa. Right? Or maybe it's not allowed to, but have to. you know, do certain things that the other group doesn't have to. You know, whatever the dynamic of the moray system is. But see, that's what they're getting at between the lines there. There's a difference in the moray system for the young boys and girls relative to the older. I don't want to be under the watch care of my father. Tough noogies. Right? That's part of the moray system. Yeah, you have no option. You may literally be killed or at least expelled for nonconformity, for antisocial behavior, right? If you don't stay under the watch care of your father as long as your father lives. Now, we all know the little between the lines there. Oh, so that's the way it works. Well, if I killed my father, right, you know, that was a big part of history, you know, for the son to kill his father just to get out from underneath that social restriction that, you know, that he's in a class that he's feeling straitjacketed by, right? And wants to have greater freedom. Yeah, and then of course, you know, we all know the tension of you know, that's between the lines there with under the care of her mother until married. So there's no hope for me. I go from one straight jacket to a different straight jacket, huh? That's my lot in life as a woman. I can see the tension there. You know, and of course, that's what we finally have begun to liberate ourselves from. Women are exploring. It's like, well, okay, now what? Now that I have this greater social freedom, I don't have these restrictive mores imposed upon me anymore. What am I going to do with myself? Am I going to make productive use of my freedom or not? You can tell one of the things between the lines of the father, as long as the father lived, you know, that early recognition of, well, you know, boys, okay, you need to keep a lid on boys, basically, kind of forever. Because no matter how old he is, there's still that boy that really could use a lid on it, you know. So that got incorporated into the moray system. Try to keep males from going off on tangents. Okay, so here we are. We've made it through the list. Now here's our third indispensable to the progress of early civilization.
What were the first two again?
Slavery, okay. And war.
Flexible and shifting social classes are indispensable to an evolving civilization. But when class becomes caste, when social levels petrify, the enhancement of social stability is purchased by diminishment of personal initiative. Social caste solves the problem of finding one's place in industry, but it also sharply curtails individual development and virtually prevents social cooperation.
Okay, so there's two elements to that paragraph, two basic elements. The one is what I was just teasing, the third indispensable. And you can see it's very literal here. I mean, it literally says evolving civilization. So, slavery, war, social classes, 1, 2, 3. And there's the flexing and shifting, flexible and shifting social classes that I told you they were hinting at, you know, up there a little ways. So that, again, avoid the tendency of falsely bringing in the existential and turning class into caste. Now, if you aren't very spiritual, you won't have a tendency to do that. You'll kind of naturally keep it flexible and shifting. But you bring in a little bit of immature spiritual energy, and you're going to want to think of something as existential, because you don't see any spirit substance where you could properly think about eternity. So you pick some temporal thing and you falsely think of it as, you know, as an eternal fact, you know, and turn class into caste. Right, so it isn't just oppression or, you know, like literal physical oppression or something that establishes and maintains caste. Sometimes it's just literally, an unfortunate, immature expression of spiritual consciousness, falsely existentializing things, not letting it being part of an evolutionary process that needs to be flexible and shifting, not to mention adaptable to greater and greater diversity, you know. You set it up in one region, it's like, well, what about all the other people on the planet? You know, if you're going to generalize this, it's going to, you know, you may be able to lock it down and it's pretty stable for this limited, not very diverse group in this little region, but, you know, what happens if you extend it worldwide? So there's the indispensable, and then, you know, getting in on that caste thing that they bring up, going to caste. Notice the point that they're making. So they just gave you this list of 10 that they said the separation of individuals based upon one of these 10 modes is predicated on enough objective human observation so that you can discriminate this from that. But it has this unfortunate tendency, all good things taken to extreme become bad. And you separate, but then you existentialize in the caste, and now there's no longer any space for human quality. And so what got initiated by human ends up destroying human. And that's what they're getting at there. Social caste solves the problem of finding one's place in industry, but it also sharply curtails individual development. Right? Your personality is absolutely unique. It has to have an unlimited potential to find definitive individuality through which it can express. Right? Technically, it can't express at all in a pure collective situation. And in order to get to using the absolute dimension of your personality, you have to absolutely individuate relative to everything else. And so anything that, you know, that eventually becomes a net negative like this relative to individuality is going to begin to short-circuit human quality, and it's going to drive everyone down to fancy animal mentality again.
Yep. In line with that they end with prevent social cooperation.
No.
Social cooperation would be possible in the class because everyone has that cosmic discrimination working to some degree. But if it becomes caste, then it becomes, well, what takes place in cooperation? Subjugation.
Yeah.
It becomes.
Or isolation. Like, you know, it's hard for there to be any social cooperation if, you know, one caste is untouchable. Right. All right. How do you cooperate that, you know, with that which you can't even approach? You got the idea. Yeah. Just various ways. See, it's short-circuiting that full social potential. So you not only have the short-circuiting of the personal, you know, individual potential, but the greater social potential. Which should be obvious that follows as a corollary. In order to have associativity, I have to have two elements, individuality and unity. Right? And if I diminish individuality potential, I'm diminishing associativity potential. So, all right. So, important paragraph, one of the indispensables.
Classes in society, having naturally formed, will persist until man gradually achieves their evolutionary obliteration through intelligent manipulation of the biologic, intellectual, and spiritual resources of a progressing civilization, such as...
Read 1, 2, and 3 there.
1. Biologic renovation of the racial stocks, the selective elimination of inferior human strains. This will tend to eradicate many mortal inequalities. 2. Educational training of the increased brain power which will arise out of such biologic improvement. 3. Religious quickening of the feelings of mortal kinship and brotherhood.
Okay, so got some politically incorrect elements there. But notice the main issue is what we've talked about so often. Even on a world without rebellion and default, eventually you get to the point where the only way that it progresses forward, it doesn't naturally progress forward any further. It requires personality management. It's an art form. You have to be artful to advance it all the way. So that artificial mode comes in. And genetic engineering gets every world to a biologic state of light and life. Right? That doesn't happen naturally. Technically, an awful lot of what happens, quote-unquote, naturally in the biologic regard is done prior to the Adam and Eve arriving on the world. That's the whole point of the Adam and Eve arriving, is to begin that artificial advancement of the people beyond what happens, you know, quote-unquote, naturally. And of course, the very politically incorrect thing, you know, when for those who believe that all men are born equal, is that, no, I mean, fundamentally, inequality exists because we aren't born equal. It's genetic. It has nothing to do with all of the things in your theory. You know, and if we just do this, we're going to eliminate all human inequalities. No, you're not. It's genetic. It's fundamentally genetic. We'll eventually get to that section where they speak to that very definitively, the fundamental assumptions of the ism that is progressivism, you know, and how it's wholly erroneous because it assumes that human inequalities are due to, you know, everything but what they're actually, you know, what the actual source of that inequality is. The uniformity of the horde is natural. The uniformities that you have in light and life, see, are the result of all that personality management, all of that artificial coordination of the system. And it begins with the biologic. And until you have that biologic in place, you're very limited in what you can do intellectually. As they're pointing, you go from 1 to 2 there. And if you're limited intellectually, then you're limited religiously. Oh, no wonder no one has ever figured out what genuine religion is. See? I mean, we just, that's the problem that we're facing. Now, when you're given the full-on spiritual ministries that we have post-Pentecost, if you humbly recognize your lowly initial estate and work on definitively consecrating yourself to favorable conditions for growth, these spiritual catalyzers that we have will take the little mustard seed of you a long ways. You can get to genuine religion, but it's not going to happen just, you know, as you roll out of bed in the morning. Okay, you're going to have to go
church on Sunday.
get into the being pious and doing the rituals very precisely. Yes, going to church every Sunday. That's kind of the bottom line, that definitive religious quickening is predicated on some very problematic elements, including the hopelessly politically incorrect element of item number one. Yeah. The selective elimination of inferior human strains. Well, that's not controversial or anything. Take that to the churches. Churches, this is what you need to recognize. That if you want to improve the number of people coming here, if you want this to be a dynamic religious phenomenon, first we need to selectively eliminate the inferior human strains in society. Yeah, see how far that goes.
You're saved in the next paragraph.
Yeah, right. But yeah.
And when he woke up, he didn't really know where he was.
In other words, I mean, there's obviously, none of us can snap our fingers and fix these problems. We all need to be very patient, and like you were saying, be humble, and be content as a tadpole. It's okay that you can't do great religious consciousness in this life. You've got forever to get to great things. Work on, just don't self-limit. Get yourself out of the way enough that the degree to which you can be grown, you will be grown. Don't willfully short-circuit the growth process, because you're a timid soul, and it's comforting to think that you've already made it to the end point, and you definitively believe, that you cannot achieve a higher religious consciousness than I've had a few times. Let me tell you about it. If you're in that mode, it's not going to happen. You're short-circuiting. Assume that you really have experienced nothing yet. And you're not far from the truth. The reality is, that when you come back to paradise in worship, on your 500 trillionth return trip to paradise, you'll be worshiping at a level so far beyond the first time you worshiped on the Isle of Paradise that the first time is nothing. Okay? If that's true, how much more true is it between, how I think I'm worshiping now and what I'll be worshiping the first time I get to the Isle of Paradise as a resident? So it's just, infinity has consequences. We're a long ways away from the end.
You should be
pretty
laughing at it right now.
Right.
There is no end.
Yeah, because there is no end, right? That infinity has consequences. It implies eternity. Yeah. All right, what else we have here?
But these measures can bear their true fruits only in the distant millenniums of the future. Although much social improvement will immediately result from the intelligent, wise, and patient manipulation of these acceleration factors of cultural progress. Religion is the mighty lever that lifts civilization from chaos, but it is powerless apart from the fulcrum of sound and normal mind resting securely on sound and normal heredity.
Basically, he's just very eloquently saying what I was just saying, very definitively. That bit that it is powerless apart, right? So thinking that you can, you can achieve some sort of definitive religious leverage in your mind, when you don't have sound and normal mind resting securely on sound and normal heredity, is delusional. So, if that's where you find yourself with kind of unfortunate heredity. Well, okay, you're a lowly tadpole. Just, you know, accept that, face facts, and recognize the differential between your lowly beginning and those ideals that you can envision is handled by a process called evolution, right? Growth. You'll get there. Just be italicized, patient. Right? So they are stressing, you know, if we can develop some wisdom and some intelligence that's predicated on that wisdom, and we can maintain our patience, one of those five favorable conditions that we always talk about, we could start to work on, you know, nibbling away at the periphery of selective elimination of inferior human strains.
Yep. Patience is a word that's easy to misunderstand. Mm-hmm. Because when you're incessantly clamoring, it's like patience is a negative.
Yes, yes.
Incessantly clamor. But true patience is being active, not passive. So it's like, no, I can't do everything, but I can do something.
Yeah.
It's, you can be patient and start and begin.
Yep. Not to mention that once you've discovered genuine reflective thinking, you know that the only way to get there is to establish a patient place first. Right? Or if you look at it in the hourglass analogy, in order to get into the upper domain of reflective thinking, you have to pass through the neck. You have to pass through the third level of meaning, the level of patience. And it's the doorway to that domain. There's no reflective thinking in the absence of patience. That's impossible. And so, is patience a static fact that is an affront to all your intellectual activity? No. That's not genuine patience, if that's what you think patience is, like you're just saying. Genuine patience is rich with active potential. It's a potential for reflective thinking that you can actualize as reflective thinking. Yeah. So, discovering the dynamic quality of patience, if you will, instead of this false stasis that seems to be an affront to the spirit of your incessant clamoring. Yeah, I mean, obviously you need to get a rein on the literal animalistic incessant clamoring, but you know, there's a spirit of energy there that, you know, that you do want to carry forward. Have a mental energy that's less about you, but still is energetic. Okay, let's get into human rights. A very loaded topic.
You just left the whole thing blank, couldn't
you? 9, human rights. Nature confers no rights on man. Only life and a world in which to live it. Nature does not even confer the right to live, as might be deduced by considering what would likely happen if an unarmed man met a hungry tiger face to face in the primitive forest. Society's prime gift to man is security.
So right there you can see going from the nutrition epic to the security age that you're obviously, like they're saying, getting a more definitive society as you make that transition. Moving out of the horde state that is just trying to keep from starving to death. I think everyone appreciates the oft-used term of natural rights. You can see what they're getting at. They'll get it to definitively here in a little bit. Nature confers no rights on man, only life and a world in which to live it. Okay, so, and then they make the very important point. The difference between the right to life and the right to live. Right? You don't have a right to live, but you do have a right to life. And of course, you know, the fact that they mention this first, you go, oh, this reminds me. Huh, it's the first thing in a certain list, little list that someone enshrined back in 1776. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Right? That among these are life, not a right to live, but a right to life. Right? They're doing the basic example that it's not, you know, the right to live is not natural. Well, it's also, you can't believe that you have a right to live. No, you may have done something where society has the right to kill you. You know, you don't have some right to live that trumps that. Okay, that supersedes that. That unalienable, you know, the right to life. See, they're pointing out that's a natural one that the Declaration acknowledges. You know, and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Right, where does that come from again? I mean, an unalienable grace of your encirclement in the Holy Spirit, you know, and the identification to your mindful self of a personality. And liberty is a spirit word. And happiness is a very high spirit fact, as we've stressed. You don't have a right to joy. You don't have a right to the pursuit of joy. You have a right to the pursuit of happiness. Okay? Okay. Joy is, you know, the feeling that you get when you have a positive response to a positive stimulus. You know, you don't have a right to a positive environment that naturally produces a positive response. Joy, 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 right? You know, you don't have a right to that. You have a right to the and it's not, of course, a right to happiness, but a right to pursuit of happiness. You have, you know, that goes hand in hand. It's a corollary with liberty, genuine liberty, right? You have the right to pursue achieving a positive response to a negative stimulus. In other words, you have a right to live in a negative environment and choose a positive response to it. You have a human right, right? Human rights.
Yeah.
Right, and of course, see, that's the whole, you know, that's why happiness is in the inevitabilities, right? Because it's fundamentally the positive response to a negative stimulus that is the whole point of the inevitabilities. Yes. Happiness, you know, genuine happiness. Okay. So just notice that how the Declaration, you know, properly embodies that truth of that natural right to life. Okay, what happens when you go beyond those limited natural facts and you get into what society brings in as additional so-called rights?
Gradually, society asserted its rights, and at the present time, they are 1. Assurance of food supply, 2. Military defense, security through preparedness, 3. Internal peace preservation, prevention of personal violence and social disorder, 4. Sex control, marriage, the family institution, 5. Property, the right to own, 6. Fostering of individual and group competition, 7. Provision for educating and training youth, 8. Promotion of trade and commerce, industrial development, 9. Improvement of labor conditions and rewards, 10. The guarantee of the freedom of religious practices to the end that all of these other social activities may be exalted by becoming spiritually motivated.
Okay, let's reflect a little bit on these. You can spend some more time on your own reflecting on all the details here. But notice how it starts out. Again, you see, number one, the assurance of food supply. Yep, the nutrition epic. All right. And then two and three, you know, defense against external and defense against internal assault. You know, again, the security age. Okay, so very obvious that, so you're adding these rights, society's adding these rights as you begin to move through those developmental epochs. And so at that point, saying, well, wait a minute, as you move through these developmental epochs, that's an evolutionary phenomenon. Oh, okay, I see. What we call rights are just about the mores system. Right, that evolutionary mores system. You know, you may have been thinking, it's like, wow, right, like righteousness. I mean, that full-on personal conformity to the cosmos. I hadn't thought about that. Is that, man, maybe that's way too strong a word. Yeah, see, in many ways it is. I mean, you know... And that's kind of why they start out with that whole bit about natural rights, just to remind you that we have this tendency to existentialize, the mores system that we have at the time, and think of this as some absolute, you know, that that we, you know, have this sort of unchallengeable right to whatever, right? It has no relativity to it, you know, at all. But you know, we need to appreciate that. And as they talk about this here, you know, just remind yourself that basically, when they're using the word rights, you know, they mean the specifics of what you're given in the context of the Mori system. You know, what is the Mori system granting you? You know, what can you expect out of this society that is properly conformal to that Mori system? Right? You can expect insurance of food supply. You can expect military defense, you know, et cetera. Okay. But obviously, before you got to the security age, military defense wasn't, you know, part of anyone's mores system, right? In that very primitive state. Okay. You move on to number four, right? That you quote unquote have a right to some sort of structure to handle the issues of sex regulation. As we've talked about, we don't get into it in detail here, but technically, the revelators use the word marriage to when you're referring to, as you can kind of see there, the family institution. You know, as the word that refers to the pairings that lead to procreation. But you could obviously generalize. I mean, you know, that's just sort of an example under the banner heading of sex control. Any sort of interaction between individuals of any sort obviously needs some, in society, the Mori system has to change and take into account greater complexity as it develops in society, you know, in regard to sex control. We talked about private property, so, you know, that became a part of the Mori system. You have, you know, now you think you have a right. I mean, initially, you know, it was thought of as horrible. You know, and then eventually it becomes a quote-unquote right, that you have a right to private property. Notice that right, the right to competition. That one has a lot of play these days. Where competition is deemed to be evil by some. It's like, no, it should be one of the fundamental quote-unquote rights, you know, in the Mori system. And it's like, well, why? Because they discovered experientially that it's beneficial. Yeah, as those who try to be advocates of competition try to remind people, it's like, you know, if you want lower prices, I mean, there's a reason why, you know, we have monopoly, you know, laws,
in name only.
Let's see. Notice that, you know, incredible, you know, think about how, you know, it came to be that humans thought they had a right to be educated. And it began as just like, you know, they recognized the necessity. Like, whoa, we really need to, clamp some of this down and educate our youth here. We can't just, you know, let them do whatever. And see, that evolves into this sense that you have a right to be able to enter into a very stable system, institution that the Mori system demands, you know, that properly educates you. Trade and commerce. And we talked about how important that is to the progress of civilization. Notice one that obviously would come in a little bit later on, you know, improvement of labor conditions and rewards, you know, and beginning, you know, it's not just a privilege that you happen to have decent labor conditions, but you begin to think of it as a right. You have a right to decent labor conditions. I have a right not to be chained to a sewing machine or whatever. And then, but what's the bottom line, number 10? You know, right there in our First Amendment. Right, the guarantee of the freedom of religion, of religious practices. But it doesn't just say that, you know, because they want to really stress it. Notice they give an explanation of why. Instead of just giving you the fact and letting you reflect on the why of it, like we were kind of doing with the other ones, you know, they put it definitively down there. To the end that all these other social activities may be exalted to becoming spiritually motivated. Right? And, you know, why is there a whole section up in part 4 entitled Secular Totalitarianism? Right? Because there's a growing militant assault on item number 10, you know, an attempt to establish freedom from religion, right? And you go, well, why? To the end. I mean, why are those secular totalitarianists doing that? To the end that all other social activities may not be spiritually motivated. They know, it is, you know, until they can get spirit out of it, they can't control it. Because where there's spirit, there's personality. Where there's personality, there's originality. There's creativity. Yeah. You can't pin it down. You've got to get it down to fancy animal. You have to dehumanize it so that there is no spiritual motivation. And that's why more and more militant, right, against what the revelators are pointing out is the foundational spark, the key.
How does that relate to the separation of church and state then?
Yeah, how that relates to the separation of church and state is what we're talking about here is the relationship between the individual and God. See, number 10 is,
right.
In the name of making sure that we keep church and state separated, these militant secularists are trying to separate God from man, or man from God, you know, if you want to say it more precisely. If you listen to all of their invocations of separation of church and state, separation of church and state, no, it doesn't have anything to do with the separation of church and state, what they're talking about. It's about the relationship between God and man, and they hate it. They have to break that, or they can't achieve the totalitarian ends that they desire. Poor man's unity. right? The totalitarian imposition of uniformity.
The church isn't a threat. The church is completely secular now.
Right. It's, you know, again, all good things taken to extreme become bad. You start, you know, with, you know, you're laboring under ecclesiastical totalitarianism, and you have the secular revolt. Like, okay, there needs to be a separation of church and state, but did that whole secular movement go away because they logically recognized, oh, well, we've achieved separation of church and state, now we can just fade away? No, they keep going. All good things taken to extreme become bad. You know, they're not trying to separate church and state anymore. They're trying to separate God and man. And it goes militant, as they point out in the secular totalitarianism section. That's, you know, notice how the revelators are trying to stress that. And like I was saying, that may be exalted by becoming spiritually motivated. That's the whole goal. I mean, we by just having the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights, you don't snap your fingers and ta-da, now we're spiritually motivated. No. Yeah, as we were just talking about, these religious practices, they're all simplistic, you know, outer life, material things. Okay, yes. And, right. But there's a potential there that you need to give freedom to, so that slowly mankind can eventually discover genuine spirit and genuine spiritual motivation instead of fancy material so-called motivation that we call spiritual motivation. And there is a conscious, willful, sinful attempt to short-circuit that, right, by humanism and secularism, you know, run amok. That's what that section's about, secular totalitarianism.
You know, this is really challenging for me because I've come to think of exalting an idea to an ideology, you know, recognize that as negative, bad, okay? But there are things that should be exalted. It's kind of a new thought for me.
I mean, give you a simple little element. You know, these other social activities may become spiritually motivated. You know, what if you could actually get to genuine love? Not all the things we call love, but genuine love. What if that was the predicate for all these other social activities? Genuine love. Personal realization of divine fellowship, right, on the sixth level of meaning, instead of just sentimental feelings on the second level of meaning, sentimentalism, right? Wouldn't it be wonderful if these social activities could be motivated by something besides sentimentalism, for instance? What if they were actually motivated by love, something that you can't look up in the dictionary, all right?
Kind of vanquish credulity while it's at it.
I mean, one of the definitions in the dictionary of the word love is sex. Yeah, well, I don't think having all these things predicated on the sex drive is going to improve them.
It's a scandal, I think.
Yeah. So, yeah. Right, I mean, none of those definitions of love in the dictionary is personal realization of divine fellowship. Okay, what else do they say here?
When rites are old beyond knowledge of origin, they are often called natural rites. The human rites are not really natural. They are entirely social. They are relative and ever-changing, being no more than the rules of the game, recognized adjustments of relations governing the ever-changing phenomena of human competition.
The moray system, like I was saying. Right? The rules of the game at that time, they are entirely social. So you know, when you read the Founding Fathers, you'll run across natural rights. I mean, all the thinkers in the Enlightenment are playing with that term, as they're reminding you there. You need to step up above that a little bit. Don't get, you know, caught up in the things that they didn't fully appreciate. See the truth that was flowing through what they were saying, because there is a truth flowing through those discussions of natural rights. And basically, this paragraph is kind of all you need to sort of properly contextualize that, what they're saying, you know, and not think of it as, oh, well, there are natural rights, and God is the author of nature, therefore they're God's laws, therefore they're absolute, eternal, existential. It all goes off the rails, see, because of that. But they're entirely social. We have to, you know, we must get this into check. I mean, the things that you can hear people say about the absoluteness of our current mores system, which wasn't even in place 5 years ago, and they act like it's been in there since the dawn of time, the way they talk about it, it's like, seriously, we didn't even think that was the proper behavior 5 years ago. Now you're speaking like, you know, people 10,000 years ago knew this as an absolute. I mean, it's really ridiculous how animalistic we're getting, how in the moment our consciousness, we don't even span 10 years of objectivity anymore in the way we talk about stuff. We've got some very difficult things, like that sex control one, to deal with. And we can't get in these unfortunate absolutist modes about this. That's one of the great things about the Marriage and Family Papers, is trying to go through that whole story of the evolution of the sexual mores, you know, and the mores about the relationship between men and women. What we now think of as an abomination was an absolutely divine thing and the only thing, you know, at one time. Everything has gone through 180 degree swings, you know, with that stuff. We can't think so absolutist about it. And as our mores system changes faster and faster, we need to give some recognition to the people that grew up in an older mores system. And you can't expect them to just change on a dime. That's not appropriate. I mean, you know, you've got to, you know, give them some understanding of just how much you're radically asking them to change, you know, in the course of their lifespan. Okay.
Well, the press has to sell papers.
Yeah, right, yeah. I mean, yeah. Right, there's all of this unfortunate exaltation of drama that, you know, sells papers, you know, sells tickets to the play, sells movie tickets, whatever, yes.
What may be regarded as right in one age may not be so regarded in another. The survival of large numbers of defectives and degenerates is not because they have any natural rights thus to encumber 20th century civilization, but simply because the society of the age, the mores, thus decrees.
Yes. And we haven't even gotten fully politically incorrect yet. Wait till two paragraphs hence. But, you know, just trying to lay that out in very stark fashion. You don't have some sort of natural right to live. Okay, and if that's too harsh, well, back it up a notch. You don't have a right to procreate. You know? See, that's what's, you know, they're trying to get you to face. Like they said back here, the intelligent, wise, and patient manipulation of these acceleration factors of cultural progress. I mean, we could start to work on this a little bit, but we can't if we have these absolutist notions that all men are born equal, so no matter how limited, they have the absolute right to live and the absolute right to procreate.
Not to mention healthcare and food.
Not mention everything else, yeah. You have a right to at least a 70-inch television. You have a right to at least gigabit speed internet. You have a all these things that we are supposed rights. Right. I mean, you have a right to an income. You have all these things. Yes. Not one shred of political issue, correctness issues there. So they're just pointing out that we need to recognize that we currently have this sentimentalism, fundamentally is what it is, to be stark about it, that we might want to start trying to assess a little more objectively. And like I said, the whole no right to live thing, that's pretty harsh. Could we at least think about procreation? Could that be not as harsh in our minds, possibly? That's what they're getting at. Okay. Here comes the punchline here in this paragraph here.
Few human rights were recognized in the European Middle Ages. Then every man belonged to someone else. And rights were only privileges or favors granted by state or church. And the revolt from this error was equally erroneous in that it led to the belief that all men are born equal.
Ta-da! All men are born equal. Equally erroneous. Out of the frying pan, into the fire. But you notice they gave you a little bit of historical. It's like, how did humans get to that silly declaration that all men are born equal? It's this kind of mindless reaction, subjective reaction to the Middle Ages, especially the Dark Ages, those Middle Ages. Right? And but there's also in there a discussion or a contrast that you can hear some people bring out that are attempting to think more objectively about human rights. The difference between a right and a privilege. You can hear people who are trying to bring in some wisdom bring up that contrast. You can also hear a lot of people that never bring up that contrast. Everything is a right because they think in very existential terms. Is healthcare a privilege or a right? For instance, things like that. Or at least a certain level of healthcare is a privilege and not a right, or, those sorts of thoughts, rather than just in stark black and white, absolutist existential terms. And also bring up European Middle Ages. So we brought up the Declaration of Independence, the United States Declaration of Independence. There's another Declaration of Rights, the French Declaration of Rights, followed not that long after the American Declaration, but very different because it was a French Revolution, and that's the appropriate word, not a suddenly of evolution, but the actual French Revolution. And Article 1 of that Declaration of Rights declares that all men are born equal. Not only that, but they have a right for that equality to be maintained going forward from birth. And that anything that would temper that absolute right to ongoing equality is wrong, in contrast to a right, right? So it's Article 1, it's right there codified, and an awful lot of societal thought in the world is predicated on that French Declaration of Rights. And Article 1 is right there. All men are born equal.
So, right, and it's probably the most socialist of states in all of Europe. And it's going bankrupt because of it.
Yeah. Not to mention, we also pointed out the fact that it's genuinely a revolution comes out in a seemingly wonderful threefold thing of liberty, equality, fraternity. Remember what we saw as we were reading the Urantia book? Right after they give the Lucifer Manifesto at the beginning of the next section, they talk about three concepts in an order. Liberty, equality, fraternity. That those were the quote-unquote things that Lucifer put forward. Yeah, so, I mean, again, it's not like anyone in the French Revolution was consciously adopting Lucifer's thoughts, but there's a pathology there, yeah, where these things get twisted around, like Lucifer twisted them around, you know, in rebellion.
So good and be so erroneous,
yeah.
And they just, it's just like you said, they're hollow.
The difference between true and false liberty is stark.
Imagine that.
And people just swallow that, right. Just like it's a good thing, and they'll do anything about it.
Like we talked about back then, I mean, you just see how problematic and controversial some of these things are, that, you know, in the name of breaking free from a lot of unfortunate societal constructs, you end up going unwittingly too far. And have these seeds, these corrosive seeds that you sow in your new construct, that are unwittingly, you know, the Lucifer Manifesto. It's just very problematic.
You know, what strikes me is there's a recognition of error, but that doesn't automatically mean you have a hold of truth.
Yeah.
You can't. Truth isn't something you can abstract from recognition.
You can't abstract truth from recognition of error. I mean, you know, and you don't even have to go that far. Just wisdom. What about wisdom? Right. I mean, there's this recognition of error, but there's not the requisite wisdom to go forward in response to that. You have a will to change, but you don't have the wisdom to change properly, right? And again, that's that. You have this impulse from your father parent. You have the will to change, but you don't have the wholeness from your other parent, the sphere of wisdom and the sphere of truth, right? To make that change properly.
Yeah, and we all know people like this, you know, a lot of people, for instance. And the thing, the difference between them and Lucifer, in my mind, is that the people we know don't understand the difference. They don't have reflective thinking on that aspect, whereas Lucifer and his buddies, they knew different.
Yeah. Eventually they knew different, right?
Or they knew different beforehand also.
They should have known different beforehand, but obviously they went down that path, you know.
They did, but they didn't go down it right away. They took them a while, and so on and so forth. But my point is that, you know, everyone sitting in this room could have thought that way without the revelation, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because, as you say, there is that feeling of inside of you saying, well, in a perfect situation, which may be seventh state of light and light, I don't know.
Yeah, right.
You know, this is the way we'd like to see it.
Right, exactly.
But people don't really look at it as to, you know, how do we get there?
Right, what's the evolutionary process that eventually gets you there?
And I don't really understand the whole theory of evolution, you know, in the terms that we learn it here. You know, I mean, it's... So it's... one of the things I've learned that happens a lot is that you get to this point where it starts to get really bad, and evolution will straighten it out over time. Because then it can either go to, you know, pardon my French, shit in a shinola, you know, or... And then when it does, you got to turn around, as you said many times, you go back to the dark ages again.
Well, part of it, wisdom is, you know, he's going along, he's singing, it's getting really bad. You know, that's, you know, doctor, it hurts when I do this. Well, stop doing that. All right? I mean, just the ability to recognize that, you know, that the pain that you're feeling is self-inflicted. You know, it isn't some sort of conspiracy imposed upon you. You've done this to yourself and the way you've set up the system. Stop making those initial assumptions. You know,
there's not a lot of philosophical thought.
There isn't, right? I mean, right. You know that's right. That's the fundamental. That's why the book is here, to give us that, you know.
Even amongst that, all the intelligence there is.
To encourage that reflective thinking. Yeah, there's lots of intelligence, but even more ignorance. Right. You know, there's lots of people that aren't stupid, but there's very few people who are wise. It's not how brilliant you are, it's how ignorant you aren't. And the other thing about it that you're bringing up there, again, it's in the secular totalitarianism section. I mean, you know, very few people step into this consciously. Many religionists are unwitting secularists. And again, what by unwitting means they lack the wisdom, right? The wisdom is the issue. It's not the will that's lacking. We don't need a spiritual uplift. We already got that. We've got plenty of will. But we don't have the wisdom to will wisely. All right? So,
and before you go
on,
a lot of people I know who read the Urantia book and have read it for a while still don't get that.
Yeah. In other words, yes.
It's more, not conditioned or influenced by the spiritual side, and the wisdom kind of goes out with the bathwater, so to speak.
I've
only gotten to that point.
Yeah, you know I'm the voice attempting to awaken this recognition. okay, so we weren't politically politically incorrect enough, so we're going to double down here.
Only in distant millenniums, you know.
Oh, yeah, right. The distant millenniums one, yes.
Yeah, now we're going to double down. This is
the weak and the inferior have always contended for equal rights. They have always insisted that the state compel the strong and superior to supply their wants and otherwise make good those deficiencies which all too often are the natural result of their own indifference and indolence.
Preach it. there it is. Just stating the facts directly, you know, that's your own indifference and indolence. And you don't have a right to redistribution, to satisfy your wants. Again, like I said, see, what's between the lines? You know, like eventually the revelators get to a full direct engagement of those false initial assumptions of progressivism. Right? You know, and getting us to differentiate progressive from progressivism. Progressive, yes. I mean, evolution is innately progressive. Right. But this ism that we use that we've latched onto that word for a name for this ism, right, is wholly erroneous. And so they're touching upon it here. Stating it clearly, there are weak and inferior in contrast to strong and superior. That's just the way it is. And like we were saying before, very difficult for anyone to face that if you were indoctrinated into all men are born equal. But they end on a very constructive note, right? This final paragraph. I mean, they're building up to this final paragraph because they need to tear down all of the false notions. We need a blank slate, and we need to think about it anew. What are we missing here? We've got this will tied to a immature spiritual activation that puts the word equality in our head. What's the bigger picture that we're missing? Let's read this final paragraph.
But this equality ideal is the child of civilization. It is not found in nature. Even culture itself demonstrates conclusively the inherent inequality of men by their very unequal capacity, therefore. The sudden and non-evolutionary realization of supposed natural equality would quickly throw civilized man back to the crude usages of primitive ages. Society cannot offer equal rights to all, but it can promise to administer the varying rights of each with fairness and equity. It is the business and duty of society to provide the child of nature with a fair and peaceful opportunity to pursue self-maintenance, participate in self-perpetuation, while at the same time enjoying some measure of self-gratification, the sum of all three constituting human happiness.
So it does get to human happiness in the end, and they touch upon the, you know, those three, self-maintenance, self-perpetuation, self-gratification, like we've seen before. Notice, okay, this equality ideal, but you can't have an equality idea. Equality is a spirit word. What's the word that needs to be properly understood for the first time in contrast to mere equality? You see it right there, equity. Yeah. That's the word that you get by bringing in a relationship to your other parent. Father gives you the equality word. You will be grown into relationship to your other parent, the mother, into a recognition of equity in contrast to equality. Now, that there you can set up a cosmic harmonious system where there is all sorts of diversity, but it sings together in a harmonious system. All those diverse individual voices. Okay. Equity. You know, just recognizing that equality is like the word equity, except it has that AL suffix. It's equity-like. It's the unity essence of equity. Right? It's the spiritual plane cut through the sphere of equity. But, you know, equity is something much greater. It's three-dimensional. It takes into account all the diversity. And through wise personal management, all that diversity sings together in a harmony. You know, they remind you of why this book is in my lap again. You know, what's the emergency? The sudden and non-evolutionary realization of supposed natural equality would quickly throw a civilized man back to the crude usages of primitive ages. That's what's in play. We are more and more willfully attempting to do that, which means it's all the more certain that we're going to have an interregnum, that civilization is going to collapse. As we're trying to realize a supreme falsehood, that all men are born equal.
Yeah, but what would he convince us of that paragraph before it's already going on where they insist that the state supplies those needs, their wants?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, and again, just, you know, think about that whole, besides just the, you know, the selfish desire to have what, you know, what that other guy has. You know, and his stuff needs to be redistributed to me. You know, think about what you would achieve if you could just uniformly redistribute. Oh, you'd have poor man's unity, right? See, again, it's that uniformity notion. And then the other thing, just, you know, notice they never miss the opportunity to try to toss in a simple little logical appeal. You know, basically a common sense appeal. It's a child of civilization, you know, is not found in nature. Even culture itself demonstrates conclusively the inherent inequality of men by their very unequal capacity, therefore. Right? You can't say that someone has, you know, lesser capacity. I mean, it's sad to record that there's almost no one that you can point to where you're going to need to use the word capacity to describe them. All right? Genuine capacity, which comes from mother deity, not father deity. The upper domain, right? The capacity, therefore. Sad to record that almost no one is utilizing the potentials of the upper domain. Right? And you know, and not to mention there's genetic limitations, again, like we were saying. I mean, we have to all accept the fact that even if we get ourselves out of the way a lot, some of us are never going to have a very significant capacity in this life. There's very little biologic uplift. So, you know, you have to count on the mustard seed fact. All right. So there we have it. They pick up right where they left off and bringing up natural light, rights to going to natural justice in the next section. And that whole sort of parallel thing about speaking about justice and what we think we have a right to in that regard, naturally, quote unquote.
You know, as you said many times from reading this, it comes across as being, you know, politically incorrect.
Right, right, right.
But inside everybody is a spirit of truth. Or not, excuse me, inside, but working upon everybody right. is a spirit of truth.
Yeah.
And so maybe, you know, one shouldn't be so afraid to, quote unquote, be politically incorrect if there's a spirit of truth that's going to help people see that maybe there's some truth that's going on.
Right. You know why a lot of these so-called politically incorrect things are in play? Because they're trying to squelch free speech to the point where, I mean, because they know if you say certain things, people will recognize it as true. The only way to avoid that recognition of the truth of that is for it not to be allowed to be said.
Right? He has no clothes on.
Right? The king has, you know, the emperor has no clothes. Right?
It's illegal to call him.
Right. And see, and, you know, see, that's, I mean, the relatives are very direct because you perforce must face facts. You know, and they can, they just state it. It's like, and you know that's true, right? And if you are so willing to close your eyes to the point where you can't see that truth, we can't help you, say the celestials. You know, Jesus said the same thing. You know, there's none so blind as those who will not see. I mean, so they put it out there and challenge you. Acknowledge the obvious truth of this statement, no matter how politically incorrect it is. And also notice that one of the reasons it's politically incorrect because the truth is so obvious. And the only way to prevent the recognition of that truth and the acting upon that truth is to outlaw that statement, to prevent it from being said. So, you know, the revelators have the courage to say it, and they know that the grace of your encirclement will recognize it as true. And you can begin the process to wisdom because you'll face facts and you'll adjust them to ideals, and you'll eventually achieve wisdom. Okay, let's pause for a moment here.